February 21st session of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Welcome you all here today. It'll be a great week, beautiful weather outside, and we've got a lot to do. We'll start by turning time over to John Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna. This is a public hearing on House Bill 5038, Department of Human Services Budget Bill, and we've scheduled hearings this week for the Seniors and People with Disabilities Cluster. And James Taves, who is the Assistant Director at DHS for the Seniors and People with Disabilities, will be opening the discussion. We also have on the agenda Mary Lee Fay and Cindy Hanna.
Great. Mr. Taves. Good morning.
Morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves with the Senior and Disability Program at the Department of Human Services. By way of introduction, I'd like to talk briefly about what we'll cover in the next couple of days. We're going to pretty much follow the script in the book and not deviate from that. So today, our plans are to do an overview of the Senior and Disability Program, to get in, at least at a summary level, into the three major program areas, including the in-home program, community-based care alternatives, and then finally institutional care. On Tuesday, what we hope to do is go through the Older Americans Act, which is the federal portion of our program, the types of direct financial support that we provide to seniors and people with disabilities, the whole area of licensing and quality of care, which we do both for the public and private sector of the care settings, and then finally get into a discussion with the Medicare Modernization Act, which will have a profound impact on the senior and disability program in the next several of years. And then on Wednesday, what we hope to do is to sort of go through the central administration and the field structure of senior and people with disabilities and the performance measures. And then, of course, on Thursday, we'll do the program rankings and the 10% reductions. Let me start, Mr. Chairman, by a way of overview, talking a little bit about Oregon's long-term care system and a bit of its history. In many ways, Oregon's long-term care system still remains the model for the rest of the country and has been for the past 25 years. And there's a series of reasons for that. First of all, 1981 was really the watershed year where legislation was passed, primarily written by consumers and advocates that created the Senior and Disability Services Division at that time. There was also major policy legislation for the Developmental Disabilities Program at that time. And the policy direction, which is still in statute, requires the department and the Senior and Disability Program to consult closely with consumers and advocates on all important policy decisions. And it really laid out the direction for Oregon, saying the key thing was independence, keeping people in their own homes and their communities, and avoiding institutional care whenever possible. And over the past 25 years, the department and the program has developed a real vast array of community-based alternatives that have allowed people to stay out of institutions. And we'll talk about that in some detail later in our performance measures. Oregon really leads the country in physical disabilities, developmental disabilities, and the elderly in the small percentage of people that we still serve in institutional settings. It's about 15% or less. In most parts of the country, it's often the reverse of that. So that's been sort of the hallmark of the Oregon system. The other thing in terms of policy, throughout all of our enabling statutes, it emphasizes over and over again a very strong partnership with local partners, with local government, and with the nonprofit service community. Most of the senior and disability programs are delivered through either counties, local government, councils on government, for both all areas of our service system. And the statutes also emphasize a very strong role for local planning in that. I think you'll probably hear from our partners that They believe in many cases that local planning has been eroded over the years, particularly as we've gotten deeper and deeper into the federal Medicaid program, which has so many strings attached. But nonetheless, that's still the hallmark of Oregon's system. The other thing that Oregon has done very, very early on was integrate services for the senior and disability population so that a senior or a person with a disability coming into one of our local offices or an area agency on aging can get virtually all the supports they need right there, all the financial eligibility, eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, food stamps, long-term care options can be done at a single site, which makes it easier for the people we serve. When you look collectively at the service system in Oregon over the years and the array of community options, some data that I don't have in the book, and it's 4 or 5 years old now, and we couldn't find recent data to update that, but as of 4 years ago, in spending practices for the senior and disability program, Oregon ranked 33rd overall in the country. But then when you broke down the spending patterns, we ranked 8th in our community-based spending and 47th in institutional spending. Now, those numbers have changed considerably in the last 4 years for a lot of reasons that we'll get into. But nonetheless, that sort of shows how Oregon developed its emphasis on community-based care. But I want to say at the outset today, Oregon's long-term care system is in deep trouble, as is long-term care across the entire country.
Before we go any further, I'm still kind of digesting the fact that the most recent numbers that we've got are 4 years old. They've changed substantially since then. And so I would like to know why we can't have more recent numbers. It would be good if we had some kind of comparison so that we know where Oregon stands, and I'm not sure why it would be 4 years old.
Mr. Chairman, a lot of the national data sources we use are often 2 to 3 years old anyway, simply by the time it's published, that it takes several years unless we do phone surveys across the states. In this particular case, we've had several issues during this last biennium. We had the nursing home tax. We had cuts that were felt particularly deeply in the in-home program and a variety of things that would have skewed those numbers, and we simply haven't been able to catch up and cross-compare that with the region and the states. We do have quite a bit of regional and national data, comparative data, that we'll present during our performance measures, but these particular spending trends we've not been able to update.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Oregon's long-term care system is in many ways facing a very significant crisis, as is long-term care across the country. And it's all about the aging demographic, and we're all talking about it. But between the years 2000 and 2020, Oregon's population of persons over the age of 65 will grow from a little under 400,000 to well over 700,000 to well over 1 million by the year 2030. Cindy Becker made the comment on the first day that old people live longer, and we all kind of chuckled, but it's actually quite prophetic, because of the 65-plus group, those age 65 and over, the fastest-growing group within that are people over the age of 85. And that particular group will go from about 59,000 people in the year 2000 to well over 80,000 in the year 2020. That phenomena is very, very important for long-term care, given the likelihood that persons as they age will need and come into the long-term care system. It's roughly estimated that between the ages of 65 and 75, about 1 out of 5 persons will need long-term care. Between 75 and 85, that increases to 1 out of 4. But once a person is over the age of 85, 1 out of 2 people will need long-term care. So again, as the aging demographic bulges into that higher age group, the percentage of people needing long-term care increases very, very dramatically. Overall, Oregon is now the 10th oldest state for persons over the age of 65. Within 10 years, it will be the 4th oldest state. So the demand for services is going to escalate very, very rapidly. There's some other huge challenges that loom for long-term care. the staffing demographic, the entry-level workforce is shrinking. There's less and less entry-level workers available over time to do this work. Even before the boomers really begin to age and come into long-term care, we have suffered some stiff staffing challenges even in recent years with high vacancy rates, high turnover in our community care settings and in our nursing homes as well, and that will only increase with time. We have a significant nursing shortage that will only increase over time, again, as people need more and more of that service. It's rather interesting from, I think, the national debate. We talked during the tragedy of December of the tsunami wave and the lack of an early warning system. In long-term care, we have an early warning system. We can predict with absolute certainty the numbers of people that are coming our way over time. But I think collectively and nationally at this point in time, we are still doing a lot more hand-wringing than doing hard-nosed calculations of what we're going to have to do. And quite frankly, I think the debate in this country at this point is still somewhat superficial. We've talked a lot with our peers across the country in terms of what they're thinking. We've looked at some of the national meetings and the literature that's coming out. And there's some common themes that are occurring. Everyone is talking about how to promote healthy aging. We know that if we can limit the impact of diabetes and some other things, that the likelihood that people will need a long-term care significantly diminishes. More and more people are talking about the need to sell long-term care insurance. But when you look at the penetration rate in most states, it's not very, very high. Most states still look to Oregon as a way of planning for their future, saying if they can convert their systems and keep people out of expensive institutional care and convert their systems to community-based care, that will give them an edge in terms of financing the long-term care bulge that's coming their way. But ironically, many of the aging directors in the country look at Oregon and say, you represent our short-term solution, but then when the aging demographic catches up with us, you, in a sense, represent the long-term problem of how do you sustain a growing population with existing revenues. I think in many ways Oregon is best positioned to lead the national debate on long-term care and on aging in particular, since we'll be, first of all, one of the oldest states. We've had a history of innovation in the state in providing community-based care alternatives, and as we all know, Senator Smith now at the national level chairs the Select Committee on Aging. I think that gives us all an opportunity really to think through nationally where long-term care should go. The governor's budget, in one of the messages of the governor's budget, we're directed to convene a long-range planning process. Governor Kitzhaber had organized a task force on the future of long-term care. We're going to jumpstart a follow-up task force that looks at specific implementation strategies. We're just in the process of organizing that right now. One of the things in terms of sustainability that we want to do first is sort of do a gap analysis, really trend out if we took today's service system with its current costs and we simply laid the aging demographic on that and then trended that out 15 or 20 years, we'll see very quickly what the gap will be between the need and even reasonable economic growth, even reasonable growth in the budget. The gap will continue to widen. So it calls for us to start thinking in some very different ways. I can only predict what we might do as part of a long-range plan, but I think some of the things that we'll have to look at is probably a tightening of eligibility for people that actually get into long-term care. We started that already this last biennium. I think that will continue in the next several biennia. But at the same time, I think we have a responsibility then to do something for seniors and people with disabilities who, for whatever period of time, are not yet eligible, even though their needs are increasing. And we need to do a lot of public outreach to do what I would consider a massive campaign on retirement planning, financial planning, long-term care insurance, choice counseling for people who, when they get into care, that they choose wise alternatives so they spend down less slowly and then don't become dependent on public financing. I think those are all things that we need to consider as we look at the future. And then, of course, health promotion and other things that can help mitigate the effects of aging. Starting with page one in our presentation, Mr. Chairman, just going briefly through the highlights. Again, the overarching goal, both in statute and in our mission statement, is that we keep seniors and people with disabilities independent as long as possible, honoring their choices and their preferences. In terms of the recent history of the Senior and Disability Program, in 2001, when the legislature passed legislation that integrated the Department of Human Services, the current Senior and Disability Program really drew programs together that came from three former divisions. The Developmental Disabilities Program at that time was in the old Mental Health Division, and then Physical Disabilities and the Senior Program was served within the old Senior and Disabled Services Division, and then we also pulled Disability Determination Services, which is largely a contract with the federal government to do Social Security eligibility. That part of the program was in vocational rehabilitation. That all came together to form the Senior and Disability Cluster. Today, we want to do a high-level program summary, again, of long-term care in the three areas: in-home care, non-institutional care, community-based care, and institutional care. And then on successive days, we'll get into the other programs. Let me talk very briefly about our service delivery system, and we'll again elaborate more on that later. Service delivery system, as I mentioned before, is largely done with local government. In both of our enabling statutes, Chapter 427 and Chapter 410, local government or local government entities have the first right of refusal. If they want to organize the senior and disability program, that is their choice. And if the local commissioners or a group of commissioners spanning several counties form a council on governments, by statute, we defer to local government in how they organize those services. Local government also has some choices then in how they develop those services. They can serve only seniors or seniors and people with disabilities, or they can choose the Medicaid program or not take the Medicaid program and simply do the Older Americans Act program. So there are a variety of choices that are available to local government. But I think increasingly over the years we've seen the largest part of our system migrate to local government, providing the entire span of supports, including all the federal programs, Older Americans Act, and both senior and people with disabilities in the Medicaid program. And then primarily the direct services themselves are done almost exclusively through the private sector, through primarily nonprofits and other proprietary organizations and companies. And then we have a very small percentage of people still in programs operated by state employees, and that's Eastern Oregon Training Center in Pendleton, and a handful of people with developmental disabilities in small residential settings that are operated by state employees as well. If you turn, Mr. Chairman, to pages 6 and 7 in the book, this describes how the population trends within our different services have evolved over the last 10 to 15 years. And the reason for the separation, I should explain, between seniors and people with physical disabilities and people with developmental disabilities, we have, and we'll explain later, two different Medicaid fund sources for these two populations. They are two separate home and community-based waivers. They serve different kinds of services and populations, and so we tend to keep data for those groups separately. But on the senior and physical disability side, you can see the steady downward trend of the use of nursing facilities over the last 10 years, and really that trend has continued for the past 25 years, although many of us now think that trend is beginning to bottom out, and as the frail elderly get older and as the need for acute care as people come out of hospitals and need short-term convalescence, that trend will probably slowly start to migrate in the other direction. The primary growth areas in recent years have been in assisted living. Assisted living was actually started in Oregon. It's a very popular form of service because of the privacy and people having their own apartments. And, of course, the in-home program. Oregon has one of the most expansive in-home programs nationally. And you'll see in starting in 2002 that the numbers taper off pretty quickly in terms of people in in-home care. And that was primarily a function of cutting some of the service priority levels, which we'll get into later. We cut levels 14 through 17, which were people with minimal needs in bathing and assistance in eating. They were terminated from the program several years ago. And so you see, and obviously people with lesser impairments would tend to be in in-home kinds of settings. So that's why you see the numbers decline there.
Just a moment, please. Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, how do we compare with other states when you look at assisted living facilities and whether they did the same kind of investment that we did, and that's actually going out and encouraging the private sector to develop the facilities as well as a state entity? We also hold the mortgage on some of those facilities. Did other states come up with the same kind of program intensity, and do they also hold mortgages on some of those facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I can't answer that off the top of my head, but I'm sure we could gather that information pretty easily. I don't know if states have a housing program like we do, where we underwrite the mortgages for senior and disability programs. I just don't know.
It would just be interesting to know whether or not, you know, that is occurring, since we tend to lead, and whether other states have followed that particular lead or not.
It does bring out a good point. To be a leader doesn't necessarily mean it's good, does it? How many other states have taken the example that we've set and are following close behind Oregon's leadership in the areas of assisted living?
Mr. Chairman, assisted living specifically, I don't know off the top of my head, but we certainly could gather that data pretty easily.
Well, just based on your experience, wouldn't it make sense that if we have a better model that others would be following it, and not merely saying, go for it, Oregon, and then they continue doing what they're doing?
Mr. Chairman, I think almost every state is struggling to convert their sort of institutional model to community-based care. I think that's happening across the country. It's called rebalancing. You hear that word all the time when you go to other states, rebalancing their long-term care systems. But I can tell you that in many states, what their goal is to get to 50%, where half are served in the community versus half still in nursing homes, whereas Oregon is way over the top on that. But in the performance measures, again, we have some cross-state comparisons, both regionally and nationally, of that.
I think we've done a good job. It's just interesting that, I wonder if it's a political thing.
Mr. Chair?
I don't follow. Yes, sir.
Just a follow-up on that. Thank you. A lot of our reimbursement comes from being in a nursing facility rather than community-based. Is that correct? Is that a reason why there might be some resistance to changing over, because you get more federal dollars for nursing facilities, living in nursing facilities, or do we still have a match with our in-home? I know our reimbursement rate's very low, but does it affect these types of services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Anderson, since 1981, really, there have been ways within the Medicaid program, with the home and community-based waiver program, that you can finance at the same match rate any community-based alternative if you demonstrate that that person otherwise would have been eligible for institutional care. It started during the Reagan years with the Katie Beckett waiver and migrated into much larger home and community-based waivers. So really, we can finance almost everything on the community side, and I think states, there's lots of reasons, political reasons, industry reasons. I think in terms of what happened in Oregon, there was a set of events in the early 80s where the entire advocacy and consumer community came together and really demanded that Oregon go in this direction and put all that policy direction in our statute. And that was kind of a unique phenomenon. I think that's happening and other states as well, but at that point in time, and we had some leadership in the department then that was very set on that course. But no, we can finance the community with Medicaid just as well as we can nursing home care.
But there is the exception that we finance Project Independence, and I think some of us would like to see, because the emphasis in Oregon was also that we want, that if people wanted to remain home, we wanted them to remain in their home as long as possible and to remain as independent as possible. And as the, I think one of the unique features in Oregon was that there was this sense of not only independence but a continuum of care as the needs moved from one level to the other one, and I don't think that that existed in other states. We, you know, it was a concerted effort to provide, if you, I call it the continuum highway of aging, and so and in talking to other states, I think some of them would like to be where we are. And the challenge is, as you stated earlier, how do we plan for the future and sustain it? So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, actually, Oregon Project Independence, I think, was passed in 1975, I believe. So it preceded even our entrance into the community side of the Medicaid program by 6 or 7 years. So that further gave sort of an impetus to Oregon to then start using Medicaid to also finance in-home and other kinds of community care. So you're absolutely right. That was kind of the trailblazer at that time.
Only because I'm chronologically advantaged.
Mr. Chairman, on page 7 is... On page 7 are the service trends on the developmental disabilities side. And really, the line that goes up is in-home supports or family supports under the Staley Agreement, which we'll get into later. As part of the legal agreement with the plaintiffs, we agreed to keep a very tight rein on the growth of 24-hour care, since that obviously is so much more expensive, but to then maximize supports to individuals still living in, either in their own homes or with their families. And you'll see also there that institutional services on the developmental disability side are very, very small, and again, you'll see cross-comparative data later with other states. With that, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to move directly into the in-home program, and I'll introduce Mary Lee Fay, who heads up our Office of Home and Community Supports.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Lee Fay. And with seniors and people with disabilities in the Department of Human Services. And as James said, I'm going to be talking about the in-home programs that support seniors, people with physical disabilities, and people with developmental disabilities. And the material I'm covering will be pages 8 through 13. As James mentioned, the in-home program here in Oregon is really a cornerstone for the delivery of services. And as Senator Winters mentioned, it really is the ability to allow people to stay at home and maximize both their own networks of care, their own community, as well as public support in terms of supporting people in homes. So it has a very long history with this organization and has really been an important critical part of our entire home and community-based program. The Home Care Worker Program, also known as the Client Employed Provider Program, supports seniors and people with physical disabilities. As early as 1982, we began using services, and again, this is where the individual person is actually employing, they are the direct employer of workers who come into their home. So the program allows individuals to have the right amount of support for a very specific task. It might be related to bathing. It might be related to mobility or transport or eating. But it's specific to what they need. And they are actually hiring the individual. They are directing their care. They're telling them what times to come. And the state is reimbursing that home care worker. Other types of things that are available.
Does this include close family members?
Mr. Chair, the person can hire relatives, family members, neighbors. What has to happen first, however, is a case manager, in meeting with a person, takes a look at all the informal supports that are needed prior to doing any payment. So if somebody was already providing supports, we wouldn't pay. However, if they're going to have their daughter come into the home, there is reimbursement, so they can actually hire their daughter in that particular program. So it does indeed include relatives that can be covered under this program.
Have you any indication or any idea of the number? You know, we're looking at 11,000. Am I correct? I mean, that's am I looking at the right number?
Mm-hmm.
Of that 11,000, what number of them are family members that are
Mr. Chair, the data is a little hard to collect because we collect data on the people we serve, not necessarily on the caregivers, but we believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% that is somewhat of a relative, whether it's a niece or a nephew or a sibling. So it's a really relatively high, and again, it's the ability to use people who are very familiar with them, who can deliver the task. So instead of going into full 24-hour wraparound services, they're able to use their resources and that network. This particular...
Just a moment. Senator Winters?
Has there been any audits of this particular program, you know, looking at... Because it's when you look at that everything is being driven by, let's say, the individual... Has there been any cost analysis done? Has there been any audits done of this particular program? And my second question is that since 40% are relatives also ending up as a part of the system as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, a couple responses. As far as information on budgets and costs, we are frequently looking at this particular program as far as what are the costs of care, how does that compare with other types of services we're doing. So we internally do quite a bit of review on this program. Secondly, we work with the local counties and do samples of anyone who is in services and look at how the service plans are written and how the plans of care are being implemented. So we do internally audits on that particular program.
What is your, looking at your rate, and I'm looking at where you're having in-home care, similar to if I was talking about care within an institution. And in institutional care, we look at such things as workers' comp rates and those kinds of things. What is the experience in this program and comparison to other programs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the program has actually changed in the last 8 months, and I think we'll, as we get into our phase two, be able to talk in detail of the budget. Mm-hmm. But certainly the impact of a program that now is able to have a collective bargaining unit has changed some of the costs of care. This program didn't have, the staff in this program didn't have access to either health care or workers' comp until a year ago, or less than a year ago. And some of those factors are indeed changing the cost for this program, of which we will get into. We also continue to look at the full cost of what happens when somebody goes into a living situation outside of their own home, whether it's a relative foster care, assisted living, residential care facility, or a nursing home. So we do look at that data, and I think when we get into phase two, we'll be able to do a lot of the comparisons at that point.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, the costs are going up substantially, and we're tracking that very closely, and we actually have some proposals as part of the budget on how we might reorganize that program to that would still maintain the collective bargaining rights of the employees but provide a better structure. Because, again, Oregon developed a very decentralized model of care in the client-employed provider program. And typically, when you look from any industry or business point of view on how you control workers' compensation costs, you typically have a work site, you have lots of wraparound supervision, you do lots of health and safety and training, you do a lot of environmental adaptation, you do early return to work programs. Those are all elements that we have not had present in this program as we launched the agreement and the workers' compensation process, and we're, I think, like 8 months into it now and tracking it very closely. And we do believe we have to look at some ways of managing it, those costs.
When you vet those costs, when you vet those costs, would you also provide us with information of what percentage of those costs workers' comp claims are actually relatives versus non-relatives?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we can look at that. I'm not sure if we'll have that data, but we will be able to. I actually think we do have that data, so we'll be able to bring that.
What you're really pointing out, of course, is that Oregon, again, is leading the way in that you can have a spouse that's paid by the taxpayers to care for their spouse, and if they get hurt, they get a long-term workers' compensation, which I imagine is somewhat unique in the 50 states.
Mr. Chair, there are just a few other states aside from Oregon who are who have a collective bargaining unit within this same kind of a program. So we are relatively unique.
Would you follow up? Would you give us a comparison then if there's other states? I know Washington also has a package. Would you give us what's involved in the comparison between what their package offers versus what ours offers? Mm-hmm.
Just between the two states?
Well, it's actually more than I think Washington.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. The closest comparator at this point is probably Washington that has a model that is close to Oregon. And both Oregon and Washington, interestingly enough, the collective bargaining for this workforce came about as a result of the initiative process. So it came through the Constitution, Measure 99, which was passed, I think, in 1999, established the collective bargaining rights of this group.
But it would be helpful, even if there are other states besides Washington and Oregon, to get the information from those as well.
Are you asking that they scan all 49 other states?
Well, I don't think the 49 states have this kind of a model. Am I correct?
Well, the question is, how many, do you know which states have collective bargaining? In this area?
Mr. Chair, I believe there is a program in California as well as in Washington, and other states may offer workers' comp, but not as part of a collective bargaining.
Okay. Right. Those are the only three states that I know of that actually have home care programs collectively bargained. I know other proposals are out there in other states that are being proposed, but of those three, I think that's it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would like to just mention a little bit about the collective bargaining because, again, it did occur as a result of a ballot measure 99, that established a home care commission. That particular commission has four important tasks assigned to them. One is to define qualifications of the home care worker. The second is to, which they are in the process of doing. The second is to put a registry together so that there is a single list where individuals who wish to be considered working for others can be identified. That, too, is being developed. They are looking at training as another strategy to be developed. And also, they are the employer of record. What that means is the person who's receiving services, the senior or person with physical disability, is the employer of that individual for everything around directing care, hours and scheduling, but that for purposes of payroll and other benefits, the Home Care Commission is the employer. That collective bargaining agreement was signed in 2003, so it is a relatively new agreement with us. And we are just at the end of a two-year period. And, again, some of the things that were covered under that was health care services, a health insurance program for individuals who worked 88 hours or more in a month, as well as a workers' comp program and a day off a year is some of the examples of the areas that that program covers.
Okay, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I understand that the person being served is the acting employer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, yes, they are. This is the original name of this program was called the client-employed provider, and they are the ones that actually are able to direct the care and hire and fire, again, meeting their particular needs.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
As an employer, I begin to wonder if the folks that are being served have the needs that they do, how many of them actually can act as an employer? I mean, how many of them can actually perform the duties of an employer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I think quite a few people, this is, it's one of the ability to be in the program, but one of the reasons that they have done so is that for the last 25 years or 20 years since the early 80s have actually acted in that capacity. Many of them may look to additional family members or supports in how to accomplish that task, but they are indeed able to say who they want to have working for them, whether the work is done right and how it meets their particular needs, and the hours and the time that they want to have there.
Follow up once more. Would it be then that a case where someone being served could have had more than one person over a period of time who had been their caregiver? Mm-hmm. And if that was the case, does that person being served who acts as an employer develop a MOD rating in their workers' comp program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, the workers' comp program and rating is very unique. It's unique to the people kind of doing the ratings as well, as far as how they are taking a look at this particular work group, which is why I think we're trying to see from the what we thought would happen to our current experience how that rating is going to be played out and costed. They're looking at the entire group of workers, not the individuals. That's why the Home Care Commission, for the purposes of collective bargaining, are the employer of record. So all those individuals for workers' comp purposes have a single employer.
Okay, where do we go on? I don't think we're going to be able to solve this one.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, we will be talking more in detail because this program has some significant issues in terms of particularly workers' compensation. And we are looking at some models that would almost do a co-employment kind of arrangement where the client could still sort of hire and fire ultimately, but there'd be some kind of wrap around employment support or a co-employer in which we deal with workers' compensation in a different kind of way. It's controversial. There's a lot of discussion going on, but we clearly recognize that we have to do something to control the cost of this program.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are two other programs that I wanted to highlight under the in-home program for seniors and people with physical disabilities. One is a program called Independent Choices. This is a very small program, and it's actually a model, a demonstration program with the federal government. And this is where people who are eligible for in-home services and have a stable living situation and have to demonstrate ability to responsibly manage the finances are actually given the cash benefits of their service needs and then direct for themselves all of the things that make it work for them to stay at home and live in their community. This is only in three parts of the state, and there are about 300 people in this program, and we're halfway through that demonstration. The last program I want to talk about does not use Medicaid. It's the Oregon Project Independence, and again, Senator Winters referred to it earlier. This particular program predates Medicaid at a point in time when the only options for Medicaid, for people who had their needs met by Medicaid, was a nursing home. This was an alternative to them staying at home. As the Medicaid in-home program became an option, this particular program really is targeted for those individuals who have assets that are a little higher and don't make them eligible for the Medicaid program, but who, with a little bit of support, can actually stay home longer and really manage the resources, stretching them out so that they don't indeed spend down and become Medicaid eligible. This program is managed through the Area Agencies on Aging, and like our in-home program, allows people to buy respite, in-home services, in-home meals, things that really make a difference so that they can stay at home. On developmental disabilities, there is also another area where we have a strong history of supporting people at home. The first one is Adult Support Services, also known as STALEY, because it was a result of the settlement agreement that was initiated back in 2000. Oregon, for a number of years, had, as people were leaving the institutions, we were in a process of developing community programs for people who had lived in institutions, creating a model that both met their needs better and was much more cost-effective, but we had little access for people who were living at home. So as programs got developed, people who never went to an institution, who stayed at home and living with their families, got put on what was called a waiting list, and that wait became very, very long. And in Oregon, as in many other states, I think there are 22 states to date, there was a lawsuit filed saying that these individuals were entitled to Medicaid services and the length of time they were being asked to wait was too long. We did see a couple states have to settle on those lawsuits that involved 24-hour, very expensive 24-hour types of services. The plaintiffs in this case settled with the state and agreed to a cost containment program that indicated if we indeed made services available to those people eligible, we could do it in a way that capped financial resources. So the average cost per person is about $800 per month, and that we developed a new model to deliver those services. We've set up a model using independent brokerages. Basically, they're a nonprofit run program. The staff in that program work with the individual to identify what types of supports they need, where they already can go in their community to meet those needs, and then lastly, where are the public resources that might be used to help kind of strengthen that network of care. The types of services that are supported through that program include job development and employment support, respite for the family, some in-home support, and community interaction. That settlement was settled in 2002, 2001, and was resettled during the 2003 period. Originally, we had anticipated that all 5,000 people who were identified waiting for services would be enrolled in brokerages by the end of this current fiscal year. In 2003, due to a lot of the budget constraints, the plaintiffs agreed to resettle, and they agreed to stretch out that period of enrollment plan so that that program now does not reach its full completion until the end of next biennium. Again, though, it is a program that's supporting people who live either in their own homes or with their families and does a spending cap limit.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Los Angeles.
Thank you. Is it true that that we are the only state that has a Staley agreement type?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Sanderson, we are the only ones that I'm aware of that has used this cap waiver, meaning that we're still using federal dollars, but we have put a cap on for an entitled group. Now, there are five other states who have taken Oregon's lead and now have included a subcap in their waiver, and the waiver is being rewritten by the federal government, and they have agreed to continue this particular strategy. The only difference from Oregon's perspective is that it is entitled. A couple of the states who went ahead with lawsuits were not successful and are now having to develop 24-hour, some of the more costly wraparound programs.
A follow-up? Yeah, that's what I had heard, that there are some other states that tried to do this and were unsuccessful in the courts. And so is that why you're saying the federal government stepping in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, I think the other states, the federal government is stepping in because they have recognized this, I believe, as a cost containment strategy. And other states, we get frequent calls from other states on the services that are developed using this particular model. So I believe there are a number of other states who are looking at using, again, a limited amount of resources, saying you will be eligible for services, but you can't exceed a certain budget amount.
Okay.
The two other programs, or one other program in developmental disabilities that I'd like to reference is family support. That's for children with developmental disabilities. Our support services is really for the program that I just talked about using brokerages. That's only for adults. The Family Support Program is a general funded program, and it is managed by the counties, the Programs for Developmental Disabilities, and the 80% of the resources in this particular program are used as respite care. The last item that I'd just like to reference for in-home programs is on lifespan respite. This, too, is a program that started in Oregon about 4 years ago and is a current model under federal legislation to look at how states are supporting respite for caregivers, for family caregivers. What this particular program does is funds locally some of the areas to coordinate who's doing lifespan respite. You've probably heard from other DHS, Department of Human Services partners, whether it's children's services or mental health, certainly seniors and people with disabilities. We're all looking for locally for people who are available to do respite. This program does coordinate access to services. They do local training, and they try and make sure people are connected with the person who's looking for respite, has the ability to connect with the person who wants to deliver respite.
Senator
Ben. Let me back up just half a second on the Fairview Community Housing Trust.
Yes.
You probably answered this question already, but how large is the corpus of that trust, and where do the proceeds come from?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wesson, thank you. I didn't mean to skip over that. The Fairview Housing Trust Fund actually came from the sale of Fairview Training Center, and there was a bill several years ago that basically said when Fairview was sold, those dollars would be put into a trust fund to be used by people with developmental disabilities. The property was sold for $15 million. However, the payments are being made over time. We are in the third year of the payments off of that property. We can use 5% of the corpus, and then after that, we can use the interest that's accrued in that trust fund. That's to date has been about $200,000 per year. We have we've ended up forming a group that has been identifying individuals who people come in with an application program. These dollars are used for people who are living at home or with their family members. And we've been able to do things like bathroom modifications, ramps, some types of housing modifications that really allow the person with developmental disability to stay at home and continue getting the care from the family and not letting the house get in the way. Every 6 months, we take new applications, and it's statewide. And we're able to, at this point, we've had over 250 families request services, and I think we've been able to fund close to 100 of them, although I can get you those exact numbers.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Follow
up. I'm a little bit confused. Property was sold for $15 million. There was some amount of money that was put in the trust as, for lack of a better term, a down payment. Is the balance of the money owed accruing interest?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, what they have is four payments, and which is why if they were to pay off earlier, it would be less than $15 million. So what's happened is we've been able to use 5% of the corpus that we currently have. So we don't have 5% of $15 million. So we've had two payments, and I think each payment I'll get back to you in phase two on what that exact budget is, but I think each payment has been in the neighborhood of $3 or $4 million.
So they, Mr. Chair, go ahead. So they, in essence, got whatever the balance was. They got an interest-free loan on that $9, $10 million, $11 million balance.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, the buyers of this property, the $15 million was agreed to because it was agreed to in installment types plans in this four-year or five-year period. If they were to pay off earlier, it would have the property cost would have been less than $15 million. So $15 million took into consideration.
The confusion is that when you sell, if you sell your house, you normally don't say, I sold it for, and you total up 30 years' worth of payments and say, I sold it this, but if they paid it off early, it would be less. Normally you say it's, you know, it's $12 million, but factored over a reasonable interest rate paid on these payments, it's worth $15 in total payments. But that's, you know, you probably didn't negotiate.
I'm sorry, I probably confused you with how I...
And this is a unique way to approach it.
And I'll follow up later.
Okay. Mr. Chair, because this is one that we're all very close to assure that, one, that we got the best negotiated deal possible for the individuals at Fairview and those that were coming out of Fairview. For me, I would like to have as much detail about this as possible. It's been an issue that was before this body for two previous sessions. Some of us pushed very hard to make certain that, one, the property was sold, and, two, that it was a negotiated agreement that would benefit this population. So the sale price is very important, plus what these payment arrangements really are and whether or not we really did do a good fiduciary responsibility towards this population group. So as much as information you can provide me, I understand that it's a long-term project there, but my interest is what's happening with the dollars.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I think we'll need to bring staff in from DAS who actually negotiated and structured the deal to give you that level of detail.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we recently did a report for our advocates, and we can attach that to our.
Well, this is one big advocate.
Yes.
Okay. Tell you what, Mr. Britton could coordinate with you who gets what, and we'll get information on what the terms were and what's been the status since then. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thanks.
Was there any questions you want to ask about this?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. That was all we were going to talk about in our in-home program.
Okay, one questions or comments? I have a question about the 11,159 seniors and people with physical disabilities who are served in their homes. Roughly what's the breakdown on that 11,000 between those who are seniors and those who have physical disabilities and are not seniors?
Mr. Chair, I can get you that information. I don't have it off the top of my head.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
6040.
Mr. Chairman, now I'm going to bring up Cindy Hannum. She heads up our licensing and quality of care section, and she's going to talk about our community-based care system and our non-institutional care settings that are not in-home but nonetheless still in the community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Hannum. I am very pleased to be talking to you today. I'm starting on page 13, and we're going to be talking about 24-hour care services. First of all, though, I'm going to go back to James' earlier comment with you in terms of what other states are doing for various community-based care options. Actually, Oregon did a very remarkable thing, and other states have had a hard time following. What we did is, in terms of public policy, we took the values we wanted, independence, living in the community. We took the payment system, the waiver. We were the first in the country to have the waiver. And we took regulation. And what that enabled us to do is design for both the private and the public sector these adult foster homes, residential care assisted living. My experience with other states is that they have had problems regarding regulation, for one thing. Most states do not allow the degree of impairment we do here in Oregon in all of these settings. they have various restrictions about nursing care, for example. So Oregon was able to very early on develop a lay caregiver system, license these, inspect these, but offer for the private sector as well as the public sector an opportunity to age in place. And in all of the care settings I'm going to talk about, we actually provide end-of-life care. So Oregon is unique in that way. Most states do not have the degree of impairment in their alternative settings. So starting on page 14, as of July 2004, we had served 10,751 folks in various community-based settings. And again, we're talking about 24-hour care in these settings. We are actually projected to serve 9,080 seniors and folks who have physical disabilities in these settings, and 5,859 persons who have developmental disabilities in out-of-home settings. Going on down the page,
do you happen to know what the breakdown is of the 9,080 between those that are seniors?
No, I'm going to have to get you that information.
Thank you.
Adult foster care is a program that has been around since the 70s. Under state law, these are licensed for five or fewer people. They're in your and my neighborhood. They are protected by zoning. They are there's actual state legislation that has that all of the wiring and so forth is exactly the same as residential care. So they are truly considered family homes. We now have about 1,800 of these, which is a decline from a high of about 2,300. This is in part, I think, due to the competition in the marketplace, but we've also had problems with liability insurance and so forth. This is a very valued part of our care system. Going on to residential care facilities, residential care in Oregon statute are for six or more, and they range in size from even a 12-bed facility to 130. Assisted living facilities are a form of residential care. They are found under licensing statute to be a part of residential care. What is different about them, of course, is that they are private apartments, ADA accessible, private baths, a very popular alternative. Now, all of these types of services I have just described, we are a purchaser through Medicaid waivered services of what is generally available to the private sector. So all of these services are, in fact, licensed and regulated. I want to briefly talk about the moratorium.
Before you do that, before we leave just the different areas, I'd like to ask just a couple things. Who determines which go? I assume that the client determines which of these he or she selects. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. This is a choice option. What we determine is if that particular facility is able to do the care that is required, but it is a choice.
And is the cost to the state the same in these various choices?
Mr. Chair, no, it is not. There is a rate schedule that is the same methodology for foster care and residential care, so the costs are approximately the same on those. Assisted living has a different rate methodology and, in fact, is a higher cost.
What's roughly the rates for these?
Just one moment, Mr. Chair, and I've got this in my little pile here. maybe I didn't bring it. The rates for assisted living go up to about $1,900. Foster care, residential care, the base rate, I think, is around $1,000, and then there are three add-ons. All of these are based upon the degree of impairment. So the
Wait a second. Now, what you said, though, the person is selecting, And so it's not solely based on degrees of impairment, because if the person can choose between assisted living or adult foster care, then they are really making a selection that's going to make a difference of almost, you know, like 90% difference in price that is going to be paid for them. I guess I'm trying to make sure I understand it, that the individual making the selection has that power, but the payment that comes for it comes without, I mean, there's no
counterbalance. Mr. Chair, that is correct. If a comparable degree of impairment in foster home and residential care will be the same amount. That same degree of impairment within assisted living facilities will be more in terms of cost. And under our waiver, the person does indeed have that choice as long as the care is appropriate in that setting.
Does the state have any involvement in directing someone who has a very limited amount of impairment toward a less expensive alternative?
Mr. Chairman, to back up a little bit, the home and community-based waiver, which is a waiver against institutional care, essentially has been interpreted legally and policy-wise in every other way, that anything that's available, any array of service within that waiver, the person has a choice to. The state can, within its rates schedule, however, determine really whether there's enough money and enough setting for the person to be served with that particular kind of choice. And even in assisted living, residential care, and foster care, there's a rate schedule. So the degree of impairment will drive the cost lower or higher depending on the level of impairment. But when you compare people of similar impairments across different environments, you will see some differential costs. And often that's because of the fixed costs of the type of program or facility that's that's operated. I mean, the wonderful thing about assisted living is the degree of privacy, and it's why it's a something that people choose and choose more frequently, because they have their own apartment, they have more privacy. And as the level of impairment goes up, then to provide the level of support in private settings increases.
Okay. I just wanted to understand that. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chair. I might also add to that, folks come into the Medicaid system either because they are suddenly ill or very impaired, or else because they have been ill and impaired and they spin down. And if they spin down, they're going to come into the system from wherever they are living, which is usually home care. But if they're already in assisted living or they're already in foster homes and they like the setting they're in, they're obviously going to want to stay there. All right, going on for the services, we have several types of programs that are comprehensive 24-hour services. The enhanced care service at the bottom of page 14 is a program we've had for several years, which has worked very well. This is taking folks who have mental health needs, most of whom who have been in either OSH, Oregon State Hospital, or years ago, DAMISH, before it was closed, and who are having difficulty adjusting to regular care settings. And we have 159 of these placement opportunities around the state in specialized facilities or in designated placements in other facilities. They get a combination of intensive medical behavioral supports, and they also get treatment services from county mental health. That's a very successful program, and we will be expanding that if there is closure of geropsych wards at Oregon State Hospital, because most of those folks do not do well within the regular care system. We also have some specialized living facilities. Principally, these are dealing with brain injury, where there are specialized rehab services, treatment services, and so forth. And they're available, again, for both private and Medicaid. Lastly, I want to talk about Providence Elder Place. Providence Elder Place is a capitated Medicaid program of all-inclusive care for the elderly. PACE is what that is referred to. Oregon was one of the first demonstration sites in the country. This is only in Multnomah County at this time. It has a capacity of around 600 folks. This, again, is very unique. This is our only fully capitated long-term care, acute care program. They are totally at risk and totally responsible for all of the care needs for the individuals in that program. Daycare is an important part of that. They have daycare sites. They have licensed residential sites. They are also purchasing through subcontracts from adult foster homes and so forth, services. This is now what is called a state plan service. It is no longer demonstration. It is one of our regular programs. I'm going to go on.
About,
Only that it might be helpful to do some cost comparisons. I'm familiar with this particular program.
Sounds like it's something I'd be interested in seeing what the cost is to the state, how it's comparing, how much demand there is. Is there a waiting list? I'd like to have a little more information about that.
All right. Mr. Chair, Senator Winders, we do a capitated payment both through Health Office of Medical Assistance Program for the acute care, and then we do a capitated through seniors and people with disabilities for the long-term care. We can get you those costs, and there is not an actual waiting list at this time, but it tends to be full, but there is sort of a capped amount that we have contract with.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wesson.
What's the number of beds that the Providence system has in their PACE program? About how many folks are they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wesson, I think our capacity through the end of the biennium is a little over 600. 700, excuse me.
Okay.
There also has been some interest in expansion elsewhere in the state for perhaps a rural health project in Marion County and perhaps in Lane County, but that is not finalized at all. That's just being evaluated.
Is this a large single complex? Or are these multiple?
Mr. Chair, no. This is a variety of care settings. This is what Elder Place is acting as, is the sort of the case management system for folks in their system. They might be utilizing nursing facility care. They could be purchasing through foster homes, just as we contract with foster homes under Medicaid. They do have a few residential sites that they operate that are actually licensed as residential care. So participants in the Providence program can be in a variety of settings, which is their choice, which are appropriate for the type of care that they need.
Okay. It's a managed care.
It is managed care.
I mean, we've seen the savings that are made in the health plan portion of DHS using managed care versus fee-for-service. And so I'm just interested in, I'll be interested in getting the information so that we can see how it's doing and what the costs are and what the satisfaction levels are and those kinds of things.
Mr. Chairman, of course, this program is Medicaid and Medicare. One of the things that I think we'll aggressively explore as we do our long-range planning is whether we can bundle acute care and long-term care within the Medicaid system. So as we look at frail elders or people with disabilities that also have extensive medical needs, whether we can do a prepaid capitated rate and whether single care coordination across all settings will, in fact, reduce costs and allow us to serve more individuals. So I think that's something that we're going to be looking at, which, again, would be just within Medicaid and not Medicaid and Medicare as the PACE program is. But I think this model potentially has a lot of value as we look down the road at the aging demographic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Senator Winters.
There's indication that you're you're going to probably look at expansion, and I'm assuming that there is some one-pager or something that talks about the successes or the outcomes of the Providence Elder Place. And if you do have that, it might be good to share it with this body. I mean, and also where the places are located. I know there's some in Northeast Portland, and that would be very helpful to give us as much information as you can about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chair, committee members, I did want to go back to the moratorium just a moment. I think I got sidetracked there. The moratorium occurred in 2001, and this is under state law. This is due to sunset.
Before you go any further, would you define the moratorium, what it's referring to? And I don't know where I'm looking, if it's written.
This is not in your material. The moratorium is a state law that provides that there are not to be any assisted living or residential care facilities further licensed unless they meet certain exceptional criteria for underserved areas. So this moratorium was enacted in 2001 in part because we had overbuilding. We had overcapacity. The success of the model actually led to excessive development. So the moratorium was put in place. I believe there is a bill this session to extend the moratorium. At the time of the moratorium,
because I was the chair that when we, the moratorium was done, as she stated, because of the overbuilding, but also we were also running into some extreme financial crisis in 01, and I think some of those same issues will play this session, and that has to do with the rates that are set that for reimbursement purposes, because some of those facilities actually rely on those rates in order to pay their mortgage to housing and community development. So it was a whole series of discussion with respect to assisted living facilities. And so that we could slow down the rate of not only the growth of the facilities themselves, but also to get our arms around the rate issue the moratorium was placed on developing any more in the state.
Yeah, you know, I don't understand this well enough. Does the state participate in providing funding for the construction of these things, or are we trying to protect the developers against themselves?
No.
Well, a little of both.
A little of both.
A little of both, and we're really looking out after the state interest because these things were expanding so rapidly. There is a need that the state was responsible out of the Housing and Community Development Trust to pay a portion of the mortgage.
Got
we
it.
Just finally had to say, stop. We can't afford this any longer. Excellent model. I mean, as the witness indicated, I mean, it was working very well, but we're running out of money. So we curtailed this thing in 01.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think many of these living facilities were developed with conventional financing, but there is a portion of that portfolio that is underwritten by Housing and Community Services as part of the Elderly and Handicapped Bond Loan Program.
Okay.
And if the reimbursement rate isn't high enough, they go into default on who pays.
I just thought it was interesting. If the government was not, if we were not involved in providing financing, I mean, would we go in and say, there's too many hotels being built, and so somebody's going to end up in trouble, so we're going to stop you from having hotels. But if we are actually providing the financing, now we have a stake in the outcome.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it might be also helpful when either Housing and Community Development or Jim, if you could get the number of those that are still, I think there's 19, if my memory serves me well, of facilities that actually we are involved with.
All right. Well, good.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, we were developing that information already, so we will have that.
Okay. So there's going to be a bill to extend the moratorium. We haven't cut the need.
Mr. Chair, the interesting point on this is there were 149 facilities at the time the moratorium was passed in 1981 who were grandfathered in because they got their development plans into the department prior to that.
What was the year on that?
2001. What did I say?
Back
in the beginning of Senior Service Division.
I'm with you.
2001. Thank you. We still have 69 assisted living facilities that are not yet licensed, most of which have not broken ground, who are on that list 4 years later.
Okay.
And we have another 50 projected residential care facilities that are on the list. If I may now, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm going to go on to comprehensive services for people with developmental disabilities. Much as on the senior and a physical disability side, developmental disabilities has developed an array of comprehensive 24-hour services. Most of the folks are, in fact, Medicaid eligible. So there's a difference here in that we are not purchasing from the private sector. These are largely nonprofit homes, but most of their income is, in fact, from Medicaid. Community residential programs at the bottom of page 15. I believe we have 571 of these 24-hour group homes for individuals 18 and over. We have contracts through local county government that provides funding for that, and they are licensed. They're generally very small, five or fewer people, as opposed to larger residential care for seniors and people with physical disabilities. Training, habilitation, goals, and so forth are provided. Children's residential care, I believe there are 160 of those, are for children who have comprehensive behavioral supports and so forth. We also have children's in-home services supporting families who require 24-hour care residing in the family home. They could be medically fragile children on ventilators, or they could have autism or other severe behavioral health needs. We also provide diversion crisis services, which are short-term services, including in-home support, respite out-of-home placements for individuals who are at imminent risk of commitment to the state for their care. They could have life-threatening issues, loss of caregiver, insufficient care, etc. For those developmentally disabled folks who are residing in nursing facilities, federal law does not allow for persons with developmental disabilities to reside in nursing facilities unless we can be assured that special needs are met. So we do have some specialized services going into those. We have supported living services, which allow people to remain at home, transportational services, and of course vocational services, employment opportunities. And there are non-relative developmental disability foster homes. There's about 487 of those who are comparable to the adult foster homes on the senior and physical disability side. We also have 31 homes which are state-operated group homes. And that's called the state-operated community program. And these are, again, 24-hour residential programs. These are for a small number of people who have very intensive support needs. 31 homes serving five or fewer in eight counties. The caregivers there are, in fact, employees of the state. All of these services... Most of these services I mentioned are licensed and inspected, and I'll be talking about that at another time.
Okay, could you just mention why we would have 31 state and then so many that are non-state, and whether or not the numbers at 31, is it increasing or is it decreasing? Just what's the dynamics?
Mr. Chairman, the state-operated program was developed before the closure of Fairview, but was primarily as a part of the closure of Fairview Training Center in the spring of 2001. We had been under a consent decree with the United States Department of Justice at Fairview for about 15 years. As a result of that consent decree, we had moved out many of the toughest people, the most fragile, or people with some very, very extreme behaviors that the private sector was very reluctant to serve. So we serve them in state-operated programs. So that's been a relatively stable number, with the exception that we added one home this last biennium for people in crisis. It's a 90-day stay kind of place. So if someone is civilly committed to the state or they're in such a behavioral or medical crisis, we have some capacity. But it's been a pretty small portfolio, and it's been our intent to keep it as a pretty small portfolio.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to finish up, Mr. Chair, committee members, with institutional care. This is on page 18. The institutions we are referring to are, of course, the state plan services that the waivers are, in fact, waivered from. So on the developmental disability side, we have Eastern Oregon Training Center. There are only 45 clients at Eastern Oregon. We have been very successful in developing alternative community placements for those folks. On the nursing facility side, we have about 142 nursing facilities now licensed in the state. Of interesting note, years and years ago, of course, most of the folks in nursing facilities were actually residing there. That trend has changed remarkably. We just received some information from the Office of Health Policy and Research, and for the year, I'll just give you this one quote to show you the change. The length of stay for 2002, 20% of the residents were in there less than 1 week. In other words, they were coming from the hospital, going in for rehab, and leaving. 43% stayed for less than 2 weeks, and the majority, 67%, stayed less than 1 month. So the nature of nursing facility care has remarkably changed over the years. This is truly a short-term rehab service. But it does remain a choice for the clients receiving Medicaid that in order to be eligible for the home and community-based care waiver, they have to meet the level of care requirements for nursing facility care, and under federal law, they do have a choice between nursing facility care and community-based care options.
And the cost, roughly, for nursing care?
The cost for nursing facility care now is about $140 per day.
Have you any idea what the percentage of the people that are in long-term care are in nursing facility care? Or the total number, maybe?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's less than 15%. I can get you that exact statistic. It can be derived from the chart also on page 6, but since those are just line graphs, don't have the, we can get you the exact number of people in nursing facilities compared to the rest, but I believe it's less than 15%.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as a final note, if we look at the occupancy for all of these living environments, I'll just share some data with you regarding Medicaid participation. In nursing facilities, we're at about 65% Medicaid out of the residents there. Assisted living is about 40% Medicaid. Residential care is 25 to 30% Medicaid. And adult foster homes are 70 percent Medicaid. And as I mentioned, on the developmental disability, of course, that is predominantly Medicaid.
Excuse me, Mr.
Yes.
Cindy, could you give those numbers again?
Yes. Nursing facility care, we're at about 65% of the residents and facilities are, in fact, Medicaid eligible.
Okay.
Assisted living, 40%. Residential care, 30%, 25 to 30%. Adult foster homes, 70%. I might also add that all of these...
That's Medicaid.
Okay, I'm missing something, because that adds up to way more than 100%.
No, no, of each population. Of each type.
Population.
From the total occupancy for each type.
Okay, okay.
The percentage.
So you're Medicaid.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the adult foster care, there are a lot who are private and only take private. Is 70% include those that just take private?
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, yes, this is out of the total number of licensed adult foster homes. 70% have Medicaid contracts.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Comments, questions, thoughts?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, we'll move on to Older Americans Act. Let me back up a little bit, just talk about our residential care. The interesting thing, as Cindy mentioned, is on the senior and physical disability side, we have a real mix of Medicaid and private pay. On the developmental disability side, it's almost 100% Medicaid, because adult developmentally disabled individuals are a person, a family of one, and typically they are SSI eligible, or they get Social Security disability income off of their retired parents' records. So they're almost all Medicaid eligible. So it's a real distinction that you have private pay and often a fairly high vacancy rate in some of your senior and physical disability settings. We have virtually no vacancy rates on the Medicaid and the developmental disability side, because we've only built as we've needed capacity, because there really is no private market there. But it's kind of a split in the way our service system operates.
Senator Montes-Anderson.
Thank you. I want to just step back to the adult foster care again, because what I hear in the community, many families have their parent, or how should I say it, have many families have their elderly parents spin down, even though they come from middle class families, etc., and then they spin their assets down through various ways so that most of the money, you know, that they have goes to family, so that the elderly person basically doesn't have any assets, so they are eligible for Medicaid. And I really feel that this is very, very prevalent from what I hear from people. And maybe there's nothing we can do to get around that, but it is using the system. And I don't know if there is any effort to look at this, to try to deal with this issue, because I feel, since I do know people, many people that are doing this, maybe it's just something we need to accept. Have you addressed this issue at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Montes-Anderson, I think maybe Deanna Hartwig, when we start talking about direct financial eligibility and support, can partially address that. I will say that there's a lot of frustration about some of the federal, both the case law and case law that now has been enshrined in federal statute, in terms of how individuals can protect or shelter certain assets or shift them to spouses or things of that sort, that we have virtually no control over. And so that has been a source of frustration. Oregon has one of the most aggressive estate recovery programs in the country, actually. So, I mean, we aggressively recover, and in fact, every person that signs up for Medicaid has to sign an agreement that subjecting their estate to our recovery efforts. But some of the other mechanisms whereby people can shield or shelter income are seem to be elusive or beyond our control. There are certainly laws governing how that is done, but it doesn't give us a great deal of flexibility.
Thank you.
I might just further on that theme. Families no longer have responsibility to take care of their elderly because the government has stepped in. And I'm very familiar with a family where the adult siblings had a major discussion about the appropriateness of just letting the government do it, because even though the family could afford to help, but what ends up taking place is if the government can do it, we don't have to. And so you have one or two family members that may pay the whole thing or a portion of it, and the rest don't participate at all because, after all, we pay our taxes, and so the government's supposed to do it. But part of the crisis that we are moving toward is because of the lessening responsibility of families to care for their own, and it's just something that's part of society.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to move on to the Older Americans Act, part of our program.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Mary Lee Fay, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. And I'm going to be speaking on Older Americans Act, which is referred to in your book on page 19. Older Americans Act was enacted by Congress in 1965, so this is one of the programs that has quite a bit of history across the nation. And the purpose of the act was to enable older adults to live their lives to the fullest with access to all available resources. Unlike the in-home programs that we referred to earlier, where it's very client-specific, where the services go directly to supporting a person, Older Americans Act are really about supporting the community. And a lot of the services that they provide are really directed to individuals in their community who are eligible. There's not an asset test or an income test. And the types of things they do are much more information and referral, training and education, and general support. There are certain things that have to be included under any plan in the Older Americans Act, things like family caregiver supports. Areas that they would be developing there would be training and how to be a caregiver, how to kind of manage the responsibilities of kind of living your life at the same time as having to provide support for a spouse or other family member. The program will do information and training on medication management, nutrition services, legal services. A lot of the legal services types of trainings are around estate planning and managing of care there. So the programs really develop for a very local interest and priorities, although they will touch on each of these areas. Older Americans Act is implemented here in Oregon through the Area Agencies on Aging. And it's a federally funded program, and the state of Oregon has to come up with what's called a maintenance of effort. A percentage of general funds have to be utilized in support of similar type programs. In Oregon, our Oregon Project Independence has really played that role. We have used the program and the state general funds delivered through the Oregon Project Independence as Oregon's assurance to the matching resources provided out of the Older Americans Act. It's about $3.5 million out of Oregon Project Independence is our responsibility for the maintenance of effort on these programs.
Okay. How will the maintenance of effort be continued or be met for Older Americans Act if the governor's recommendation of eliminating OPI goes into place?
Mr. Chair, I believe the governor's recommendation of OPI is reduced to the amount of the maintenance of effort.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that. It's gone.
in the governor's budget, there's a hope that it would be at the maintenance of effort, but the dollars are gone. In fact, the elimination was more than what was in the current service level.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It is a budget error that we're working on right now as part of the governor's reshoot that we'll have to bring forward. But the reduction was counted several times in the budgeting process, and so we actually have a hole where we need, I think, about $3.7 million to keep our maintenance of effort agreement with the Older Americans Act requirements.
Okay, so the when the correction comes out, you're saying that OPI will be funded according to the governor's revised recommendations at the maintenance of effort level?
Mr. Chairman, I can't entirely speak for what the governor's revised budget will look like, but the maintenance of effort is $3.7 million to continue, and that's what the $21 million in Older American Act funds are contingent on. So we certainly will make that recommendation, and we'll go from there.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the only other thing to talk about the Older Americans Act, primarily the Older Americans Act is the vehicle of funding for area agencies on aging across the country. And here again, Oregon is a bit unique in that in the early 80s, when the whole senior and disability program really took root, there was a conscious decision to combine the Older Americans Act, Medicaid, Oregon Project Independence, all under single umbrellas. And that's why in this state, unlike many other states, the area on agencies on aging provide the full range of services, not just the federally funded Older Americans Act. And that is unique to Oregon. Mr. Chairman, we'll keep moving on here. We're going to move now into direct financial support. And with me is Deanna Hartwig, who is administers our Office of Federal Resources and Financial Eligibility.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Deanna Hartwig, and I'm here to talk about the direct financial supports provided by the Department of Human Services. We determine eligibility to provide financial support or services to certain low-income seniors and people with disabilities. On page 20, you will see the numbers of individuals that we serve in each program. They are not broken down by those who are aged versus those who are disabled. We can provide that information to you with the other that you have requested.
Thank you.
The Oregon Supplemental Income Program provides medical and cash assistance to low-income, aged, and disabled individuals through state funding. The Oregon Supplemental Income Program is the gateway to Medicaid. As mentioned earlier, when individuals present at our local offices, their eligibility for all programs is determined at the time of intake. We will look at their eligibility for the Oregon Supplemental Income Program, for Medicaid, for the Oregon Health Plan, for food stamps, and other possible benefits that might be available to them. The majority of clients that are served by seniors and people with disabilities are not receiving long-term care services. Rather, they receive a small cash grant and the Oregon Health Plan coverage because they are eligible for Oregon Supplemental Income Program. You can qualify in three different ways. The Supplemental Security Income Program is a federal means test program administered by the Social Security Administration. Individuals must be age 65 or older, or have a disability as determined by that federal agency. If you are eligible for supplemental security income, you are eligible for Medicaid. The second program includes people who receive Medicaid-funded long-term care waiver services. The income standard for this group is up to 300% of the supplemental security income standard. And the third program includes those individuals who are residents of a mental health facility and receive non-waivered services in a community setting. One of our other Medicaid programs is the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program, which was designed to enable people who have disabilities to work while maintaining their Medicaid coverage. The loss of Medicaid coverage, including personal... Yes?
Okay, Mr. Britton.
Deanna, just a point of clarification. On the first, on the supplemental security income as the way to get
yes.
the OSIP, the $20.40 annual supplement from the state is a requirement. Is that?
That is correct. That is another that is another maintenance of effort amount that is required by the federal government for this type of program. So we must always find a way to deliver that $1.70 a month or $20.40 annual supplement. report. For people currently on Medicaid who want to work, we were able in 1999 to get a federal state plan amendment to incorporate this option for our individuals with disabilities who wish to work. If you're eligible for the Employed Persons with Disability program, that enables you to maintain your medical coverage, and if you're eligible to receive other kinds of services like a personal attendant, that can be maintained even though you are working and earning wages. Other programs that we offer are special needs. We use special needs payments to reduce the need for more expensive long-term care. Examples of some of the payments that we provide to individuals would be payments for emergency response systems, for telephone bills, shelter exceptions, or minor home repair. We're also required by federal law to provide payments for Medicare beneficiaries who meet certain income guidelines. And there are two major categories for this. The Qualified Medicare Beneficiary Program requires the state to pay the Medicare Part B premium, annual deductibles, and coinsurance charges on Medicare-covered services for the Medicare recipients who have income at or below the federal poverty level. There's currently no drug coverage for these individuals unless they also qualify under a Medicaid program. In addition, for individuals who have income from 100% to about 135% of federal poverty level, we buy in for their Part B Medicare premium only. We also implement the food stamp program under the direction and policy that's established by Child, Adult, and Family Services. We have a general assistance program as well that functions as a safety net for Oregonians who suffer from chronic mental or physical disabilities. If you're eligible for general assistance, you receive a small cash assistance grant each month. That's currently $314 a month. People eligible for this program must also be applying for supplemental security income through the Social Security Administration. If you also meet our service priority levels, you're eligible for services during this time as well. And this program is not funded in the governor's recommended budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator, welcome to us. Nice to see you, Senator Carter.
We also offer an employment initiative. Yeah. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Yes, please. So if this is not funded in the governor's budget, where is there an area where there is a makeup between that whole maintenance of efforts issue if a person does not have money to pay for rent and medication? And so where that supplement comes from?
At this point in time, if this program does not exist, I'm not aware of any other state program that would enable someone to receive those kinds of services.
State or federal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, typically the general assistance program, the general funds in that have not been considered part of maintenance of effort for any of the other federal programs, unlike the supplemental income program, the OSIP.
That has a very distinct federal requirement for maintenance effort. This is not in that category.
How many people, Mr. Chairman, how many people do you think you have in this category?
Currently we're serving 423 people in the general assistance program.
And can you just profile for me the average amount of dollars that this person have in terms of income?
I apologize, I don't have that with me, but I can provide that. It is extremely minimal, but I will provide that. We can give you the amount of income, resources, and other criteria.
A follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. Does the average person of the 423 live in subsidized housing, or food stamps, or something of that nature?
That is also additional information that I'll need to research. Some of them would be eligible, and I don't know about the subsidized housing. I can tell you about other public benefits that we might be providing them.
Right. Mr. Chairman, my reason for questioning that if this program is not funded, and these people are on fixed income, what about those basic, you know, those core values that we have in terms of a person being able to have some food and some shelter? And then at the same time not having to make a decision between whether they get medication this month or whether they pay the rent or buy food. Mm-hmm. And so I think that information would be
very welcome, I know, by me, so that we can be making more informed decisions about the conditions of these people with no funds in the governor's budget. And how much was that that had been funded? What was the cost of that? Do you know? Do you have that, James?
What's the exact? $4.7
million. Yeah. But we'll get that for you. We'll get the exact number. Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, back to your question about the level of resources. When this program was cut in the previous governor's budget, and then the legislature partially restored this program, but restricted its access to people that were SSI eligible or applying for supplemental security income. And then to the degree that they become eligible, then we recover. If they get a lump sum payment, we apply that back against the cost of the general assistance program. So the long and short of it is these folks are quite poor.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I think that is important, you know, if they're young people, you might can say, oh, they have the option to go out and hustle a little bit. Can you see a 70-year-old person who has not been able to work for anything else, not trying to hustle to make the difference between rent and food? And I just think it's important that the legislature knows that. Thank you.
So we would appreciate if you just give us a summary as to the effects, you know, who the people are and roughly what their situation is and what the consequences will be.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I did find some information. For the general assistance program eligibility, you must be between age 18 and 64. You must have an income below $314 a month. Your resources can't exceed $1,500, and there's a $50 cash resource limit.
And I think in this state we call that abject poverty. Moving right along. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you.
We also operate an employment initiative program designed to provide assistance to clients who have a disability and desire to work. The services provided under this program do not duplicate services that might be provided through the Office of Vocational Rehabilitative Services. But typically what we provide to these individuals are assistance in employment preparation, job training, career planning, employer community education, and some post-community employment type supports. Again, this program is not included in the governor's recommended budget.
Okay, just a moment. Mr. Britton.
Deanna, it's never been exactly clear for me what the difference between the Employment Initiative Program and the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program is. Can you talk about what those are and how they are distinguished from each other?
The Employed Persons with Disabilities is a Medicaid state plan eligibility type program. It allows individuals whose incomes are higher than usual to be able to maintain their Medicaid. For the Employment Initiative Program, it is a program of services to individuals who are currently Medicaid eligible. It provides additional assistance to help them find and maintain employment. So what we did with the Employed Persons with Disability Programs primarily is say, you can have resources of $5,000 instead of the $2,000 that is required for current Medicaid eligibles. You can have earnings above the amount that would normally make you ineligible. You also have some client contribution, some premiums and copays that go along with that program. There are approved accounts where you can place some of your earnings to help you plan for retirement, to plan for adaptations to a vehicle or purchasing a vehicle to help you get to and from work because you require special adaptation. So the difference is a state plan Medicaid program versus a employment service opportunity skills training type program. Is that helpful?
To me it is, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
And finally, I would like to give an overview of the Disability Determination Services. This program is a 100% federally funded program. You'll find a brief description of it on page 24. The Social Security Administration contracts with seniors and people with disabilities to make eligibility determinations under Title II and Title 16 of the Social Security Act for individuals who claim they are unable to work due to a disability. The Title II Social Security Disability Insurance is for claimants who have worked and meet insured status requirements. Title 16, the Supplemental Security Income Program, is for claimants who meet federal definitions of financial need and corresponding disability.
Committee, Mr. Chairman. The next, and I guess a question here, the next section is a pretty extensive on our licensing quality of care. Do you want us to proceed, or shall we start up tomorrow?
Why don't we start up tomorrow?
Okay.
Before you leave, is there any questions, comments? You've given us a lot of information, and it's going to be a lot to digest. If we have some additional questions, we'll get back with you on it. But why don't we start our new segment tomorrow and go ahead and adjourn the meeting for today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We are adjourned.